This is a Pinball News production.
First of all, I want to thank everyone for being attending the 5th Annual Pacific Pinball Exposition here in San Rafael. I'm the chairman of the board of the Pacific Pinball Museum. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, and it's nice to see some familiar faces and a lot of new faces out in the audience, too. So, again, thank you for coming. The whole reason that this festival and this exposition and, frankly, our museum works at all is because of the support and enthusiasm and energy and financial support of people like you. So thank you. Thank you very much. Tonight, we're in for a real treat. What we're going to be watching is a documentary that was filmed in late July of this year of a very prolific pinball designer by the name of Wayne Nyans, who turned 93 years young in July of this year. And he, if you've spent any time around pinball at all, I'm sure that you've had your hands on the two flipper buttons of a game that has been designed by Wayne. His career spanned no fewer than 6 decades. He designed over 177 or almost 180 different titles. 47 of those years were spent with the David Gottlieb Company alone. And I had the pleasure, along with Will White from Los Angeles, of filming Wayne at his house in Mountain Home, Arkansas, in late July of this year. And it was really interesting because when you ask Wayne a question, he doesn't just give you a one or two word answer. He gave you an entire story. And after a 3 hour and 15 minute, almost 3.5 hours of videotaping him in his living room, he immediately stood up and said, "Okay, who wants to play a game of pinball?" And he challenged me and Will to a game that he had out in his garage. And the story of how he got that game is on the film tonight that you'll enjoy. So, again, many of his, if not all of the games, if you see in the wood rail section and a lot of the wedgehead from the 50s and 60s, were designed by Wayne Nyans. Games such as Queen of Hearts, Dragonette, Coronation, wedgeheads from the 60s such as Slick Chick. So as you go back on the show floor, I think you'll have a deeper appreciation and understanding of the person who was behind many of these games that we've so many generations have enjoyed and played over the years. And this is really an important focus for us as a museum, is to have an oral history of the designers and the engineers and the artists, the people who went and actually built these things from many years ago, because it's one thing for us to provide you a list of the who and the what and the where and the when, and you know, anyone can supply you an Excel spreadsheet that shows you of what game was made in what year. But when you're talking about the how they were actually put together and the why behind it, I think that deepens your appreciation and your understanding and your enjoyment of playing the pins. So this is the first, actually, in a series of many, what we hope to be many, interviews and of industry designers and artists, etc. And I can't think of a better person than to begin with Wayne Nyans himself. So enjoy the video. First, I can't tell you what a treat it is today, Wayne, to be able to sit here in the living room of your house in Mountain Home, Arkansas, talking to really a living legend in the pinball industry.
Well, it's a treat for me to have you guys come all the way from California out here just to interview me, and I appreciate all your trouble getting here and your problems, and I'm glad to meet you. And
my name's Larry Zartarian. I'm here from the Pacific Pinball Museum in Alameda, California, and the Pacific Pinball Museum has close to 700 different pinballs in our collection, in various states of restoration and refurbishing, and many of those machines were designed and made by you, Wayne. So it's really a treat to be able to talk face to face
Well, it's a pleasure having you here. So
for bringing so much joy and pleasure to so many people who grew up and played pinball. And what we're trying to do is really preserve and promote pinball so that it not only has a place in America's past, but in for future generations as well.
Well, great. It's great to... Okay. Someday maybe I'll get out to the museum.
We really hope you can. It'd be really
interesting. I'll try to. Maybe I can make it next year. But, you know, when you're 93, well, you're pushing it a little bit.
Okay, what I thought we'd do is start by just talking about your childhood and your what got you interested in the pinball industry and how you ended up being such a prolific pinball designer. And you were born in 1918 in Mason City, Iowa?
That is correct, yeah.
But you lived most of your life in Chicago,
yes,
Illinois?
Yes.
What were the circumstances that brought you to Chicago?
Well, my father was an electrician, and he did a lot of electrical work around Mason City, Iowa, and on this particular day, I don't have the date down in my mind at the moment, but he was killed in an industrial accident, and that was in 1926. And I was 8 years old at the time. My sister was 9. And we were living in, like we say, Mason City, Iowa, and there's no relatives in Mason City, none of our relatives. And so my mother decided to move to Chicago, where she had a sister and two half-brothers, which you need family around you when you're in that condition. So we moved to Chicago when I was 8 years old, and that was in 1927. And we had a pretty good insurance policy, and of course my mother invested it in the stock market like everybody else in the 28, 29 era. And then of course you know what happened, and then we were broke, and so my mother took in roomers and boarders and did all that kind of stuff to get by. And that's what got me into the newspaper business. I as soon as I could get around by myself, which is around 10, I got delivering newspapers, and I had a newsstand and one thing or another. And when I got into junior high school, I took mechanical drawing for 3 years in junior high, and mechanical drawing 3 years in high school, and that. I loved to draw, and I was good at it. I probably one best in the class, I would think. And they sent a notice around in February of 36, and I was graduating in the spring of 36. And of course, I was looking for a job because when you're graduating high school in the Depression, the middle of the Depression, when people were eating out of garbage cans and there were bread lines all over. You're a little concerned about how you're going to make a living, and I making a living was utmost in my mind. So anyway, they sent a notice around that a company wanted to hire a draftsman part-time, anybody that would be interested. And so, of course, I ran down and applied for the job, and not expecting to get it, because when I got there, there must have been 20 kids standing in front of the door waiting to for an interview. But all he did was take our name and a telephone number. And I had a vision of a drawing. I had my drawing set with me and everything. I thought I'd have to draw a plate or do something. But nothing. And not even an address. Just telephone. And so I went home and I said, oh, that's a lost cause. There must have been 50 kids there, you know. Mom, I told my mom, 50, I'll never get the job. And then the phone rings. It's Eric Buenander. Start tomorrow. Come in early as you can. So I got out of school at 2 o'clock or thereabouts, and so I went down. I brought my plate with me, and my drawing equipment with me, and everything. I go in there, and he puts me to work on a drawing board. And he said, "Now you take your orders from this gentleman over here," and it happened to be Lynn Durant. And Lynn Durant was a young man at that time, and of course Lynn Durant went on to become the president of United Manufacturing.
Sure.
And so he was my boss, and he told me what to do, and he gave me my first job. And so he and I became very good friends. But anyway, then I drew the plates, and I didn't fill out anything. They didn't know my name, my address, or anything about me. I didn't know how much I was making. And I came 6:30, Eric, Bjorn Henrik stepped in the room, and he said, okay, you might as well go home and come back tomorrow. And I said, well, wait a minute, how much am I making? And he says, 30 cents, 30 cents an hour. So I said, wow, okay, 30 cents an hour, you know, that's pretty good. So that's the way it went.
What kind of machines was Western supply designing and building in those days?
Well, at that moment, no. Well, yeah, pinballs, but they were making everything. You know, trying. Nobody knew what to do. Business was so terrible, and they were trying everything. I think we had more designers working at Western than we had people on the line.
When you were young, say in your teenage years, were you interested in pinball playing?
I never even heard what a pinball was. When we walked in the door at afternoon. And for the interview, here was these pinball machines all going down a line, and all these guys talking together, and we said, what are they building here? None of us knew what a pinball machine was, because in Chicago, you didn't see a pinball machine. They were outlawed in Chicago, so they didn't have them at that time.
And yet, that's where all of them were being built.
Yeah, they were all built in Chicago. Yeah, but they weren't legal in Chicago, of all places.
Can you tell us what led you to leave Western and how you ended up at Gottlieb?
Well, when Western went bankrupt. They went bankrupt twice while I was there.
Okay, so you're talking about your work at Western and how you were testing.
Yeah, I was testing, and you know, Jimmy was going to take care of me. I thought that meant a little more money. You know, money was important to me, always was important. So Jimmy came in. He always came in the back door, and first thing he hit was my station. How many games we get off, Wayne? You know, and I said, well, we got 10 off or 12 or whatever. You know, he said, well, speed it up. Tell him to push him on at the other end. You know, you have a rough, miserable character. But anyway, I said, Jimmy, I'd like to talk to you about something. And he said, what do you want to talk about? And I said, money. And he said, well, all right, he says, I'll talk to you later. I'll call you up in the office. And I said, okay. So he didn't call me until 1 o'clock. And so I went up in the office, and he said, sit down, Wayne. We want to talk, you know. And I sat down. He said, what seemed to be your trouble? And I said, well, Jimmy, you know, you said you were going to take care of me when we got back on our feet. And old Tony Burgo alongside of me here is making a nickel an hour more than I am, and I think you ought to take care of me. And he said, well, yeah, you're probably right. He said, I'll give you 2.5 cents. So I looked at him, you know, and I didn't want to start a fight with this guy. He's pretty big, you know. And I said, okay, Jimmy. And so I turned around and walked out, and I was, you know, I was 19 years old, you know. So I walked around and down the stairs and over all the way to the end of the factory and to my spot, and all this time I'm thinking, you know, I can't take this. I can't take it. I packed up my toolbox and walked out the front door.
Right then and there,
1 o'clock in the afternoon, 1:30 by this time, you know. And I got on the streetcar and I was heading home. Didn't have a car. And I was thinking, boy, what a crazy nut I am. And there's bad times like this, and I no job. There's a lot of things I could do. I could become a repairman, I could do this, I could do that, and I'm thinking, you know. So I go by Genko, and I know a guy at Genko. I'll get off and I'll go in there and see if I can get a job. Well, by the time I got off, it was already at Diversey. And I got off Diversey, and Genko was 2 blocks back, and Gottlieb was 2 blocks down Diversey. And so I stayed there and thought for a few minutes, and I said, you know, Harry Mabbs is working, designing at Gottlieb. And I'll go over to Gottlieb, and maybe they'll hire me. You know? I know somebody at Gottlieb. So I went over there, walked in the front door, and the girl says, what do you want? And I said, I'm looking for a job. And she said, can you make pinball machines? I said, oh, yeah, I'm an expert. You know. And so she calls the superintendent, who was Morris Priestley at the time. And so he came out and got me, and I went in his room where he was working, and And he interviewed me for 5-10 minutes, that was all. And he said, okay, you're hired. And 10 cents an hour more than I was making.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah, and so he took me out and put me on the playboard line. I was a playboard tester. At the end of the playboard line, I became the tester. And 10 cents an hour more, and we worked overtime. And so we worked till, I don't know, 6, 6:30 that night. And I go, oh boy, this is great, you know. So I get on a streetcar and go home, and I get off the streetcar and start walking up to our apartment. And here was Jimmy Johnson sitting in his big old Lincoln. He spotted me, boy. He gets out of that car and he comes over. This big giant of a man, you know, shoulders like this, and he hovers over me. And, what's the matter with you, kid? You know, what are you leaving me for? And I, oh, you caused me nothing but trouble. And he's yelling at me out in the street. And I said, come on up in the apartment if you want to talk to me. You got to come on the apartment. So he comes up in my apartment. He sits on the damn porch. And he gives me the sales pitch, you know, why I should work for him and so on. And my mother's standing there. See? And, of course, she from the old school and so on. And so he's yelling at me, carrying on. And I said, well, I'm working at Gottlieb, and I'm very happy. I got 10 cents an hour more than you pay me. And he said, I'll match it. I'll take care of it. I'll take care of you. Don't worry. I'll do this and that. But I knew Jimmy, you know. He left. And my mother says, Wayne, you got to go back to Western. Now, you got to do that. You can't stay at that Gottlieb company. You don't know anything about them, but you know this guy's good. You know, he's good. And I said, well, I don't know about that. And all night long, this went around in my mind, you know. And come morning, I said, there's only one thing I can do, and that's to go back to Gottlieb. And I did. I went back to Gottlieb and back to my playboard job, you know. And everything went fine until about 1 or 2 in the afternoon. And I'm busy working, and someone taps me on the shoulder, and I turn around, it's Dave. I never met Dave. I knew who he was.
Dave Gottlieb himself?
Dave himself. I knew who he was because I had met him, or not, I'd seen him at the conventions. So I knew who he was, and he says, are you Wayne Nyans? I said, yeah. I said, and he said, you work for Jimmy? I said, yeah. And he said, well, you know, he's up in my office up there, and he's telling me I should fire you. And I, whoa, you know. And he said, what happened? I'd like to know exactly what happened. So I told him the whole story, you know. And he listened to me. He said, all right. He said, I tell you what, Wayne, you never have to worry about a job. As long as I own this company, you have a job. And from that moment on, him and I were friends. And I could walk in his office and talk to him, and I did many, many times because we were friends. We became close. And he was true to his word. And so he went back up to the office, I guess, and I could just picture him with his big cigar pointing up at all. Jimmy, you get them out of here and stay out of here, and I don't want to ever see you, and you better not touch that Nyans kid, you know. And so that's the way I started at Gottlieb. So I go back to my playboard station, and this guy is working there, and he said, you're not going to get this job. This is my job now. You left it, you know. And I, well, what am I going to do? So I'm walking around the factory not doing anything, and I ran into, I don't know, probably whoever it was. And they said, go in the engineering room and go to work. So I went up to the engineering room, and they put me to work, and I think they sent me over to help Harry Mabbs, who was in another room adjacent to the engineering room. So I loved that, help Harry out. So, you know. Well, this lasted about maybe a month or two, and we had to go back to Ponzer again in New York. And Dave come to me, want to go back to Ponzer? And I, yeah, sure. So he's okay, but you come in the office and see me before you leave. And I said, okay. So I go back in there, and he hands me a roll of bills and the ticket, and he said, go take care of Ponzer. And I said, okay. And he said, now, I want you to remember one thing. You're working for Gottlieb. And when you work for Gottlieb, you go first class.
Oh.
Now, I got you a reservation at the Edison Hotel. Now, the Edison Hotel was a brand new hotel at that time, at that date. And he said, now, I want you to eat in the hotel. I don't want you to stay out of that automat. And he said, and don't bring me any list of what you spent. He said, I don't want to see it. And then I worked... I helped Harry Mabbs, and I helped the engineers, and whatever. I just filled in jobs in the engineering room. And,
when was it you first designed your first game at Cotley?
Well,
what year was that, and how did that happen?
Well, we moved from Polina Street to Costner Avenue, and when we got over there, then I got the job of building test fixtures. Test fixtures, we had to build a set of test fixtures for every game that we made, and we had to have three test fixtures for the bottom panel and three for the playboard, or three for the light box. And it was my job to build the test fixtures, write the instructions and on every game that came along. Well, I soon found out that I could make those test fixtures like nothing. You know, I could make them in a hurry, you know, and which I did. And then I had time to spare. And so I make me a game, you know. So I got me an empty cabinet and a blank board and put it alongside of my bench and start laying out a game and then, you know, and start working on it. And then the next game would come along, I had to stop and build my test fixtures. And I spent 2 or 3 weeks on that. And then I had another, maybe a day, maybe a week, maybe an hour, but not much time. And I would work on the game. So the first game I built probably took a year to make, something like that, which was College Days.
College Days, yeah. What year, 19?
That would be 49. But I probably made it in 48, see? 48 to end of 49, probably. And then I made the next one, basketball, and under the same circumstances, part-time. And then Casey Jones, part-time. In the meantime, Harry Mabbs was building games. He was our chief designer, and they built those three games in 49 of mine, and Harry had built, I think it was 9 or 10 games that year. And they all did fairly well. You know, they weren't the best games in the world, probably, but they were good. They were good games. Particularly the first one was an excellent game. And I called the game College Days, D-A-Y-S, and Parker changed it to Days, D-A-Z. So that was good, you know. Parker was that way, and he was sharp and smart and comical, funny. He was a funny guy, but he had a lot of humor, and that's where I got started in design, which was great. But before, to back up just a little bit, in 47, I made the bumper switch. And got a patent on the bumper switch.
That's the spoon switch?
The switch with the silver points on it. Mm-hmm. Up to that point, they were using a switch. It was a carbon ring with a stem going into it. And every time that stem made contact with the carbon, it was an arc. Mm-hmm. And it gradually burned that carbon away. And pretty soon the carbon would wear away and fall out.
Yeah, it's horrible.
And the bumper was dead. Now, can you imagine that arrangement with a pop bumper? It could never have stood up.
No.
So so my electrical switch really helped when the pop bumper came along. See, the pop bumper came along later than that.
Oh, that's right.
So anyway, but that wasn't my first design. I designed other things besides pinballs. See, now back in 37, I designed the free play unit. Now, I know other people claim to have designed the free play unit, but I was in the engineering room at the time when Jimmy Johnson bought in the push type chute.
Oh, sure.
That he bought the rights to, and he was showing it to all the engineers, and I was standing there kibitzing with the guys, you know, sticking my nose in where it probably didn't belong. But he showed the guys this, and now I want you to build a game around this. This is good, you know. They said, "What is it? How do we use it? What is it?" And I, you know, had a pretty good idea what to do with it. And I went off by myself, and I took a GM Laboratory step switch, mm-hmm. and stepped up and reset, and I added another coil on it because there were no knockoff buttons at that time, so we didn't know what to do. So we thought a free play unit, or at least this is my thinking, should step up, step down when a game is played. And when somebody walks away, you want it to reset. So you had to have a reset coil on there, too. Anyway, I made the unit, and I showed it to Jimmy. And Jimmy says, "Well, I don't know whether that'll work or not." But I said, "Well, I'll put it in a game, and you'll see how it works." So I did. And it worked fine, see. So then the engineers all look at it and they all poo-poo and all this stuff, you know, it was, that'll never work. No, no one will ever play that game. And so so Jimmy calls in the president of GM Laboratories, who we were buying our step switches from, and he gave me a check for $50.
$50,
and I signed away the all rights to the free play unit for $50. Of course, I'm making 30 cents an hour. $50 was
a lot of money.
Still. Jimmy came to us and to about a half a dozen of us guys, and he says, "I'm going to get a game in here at 5 o'clock, and I want you to copy it before morning. I got to get it out here before dawn." And he brings his game in, and they divided it up. Each one of us got a little section of his game, and we built it, and we put it together, and we had a copy of this game, and we shipped the other one out at dawn. And, you know, crazy stories. And you know, the game was a flop, absolute flop. It was a game with a hair dryer, a motor, in the base, and had a ping pong ball that sat above the above this blower, and you turn the blower on and you blow the ping pong ball up, and you try to drop it in pockets.
Oh, interesting!
And it dropped down and scored. You know, not a bad idea.
Oh, sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, but it was a flop. You know, but it just shows how one company made something and the other company copied it before they had a chance to ship it out of town. The only games I would ever look at were the bingo games. I love to look at bingo games. I love the circuitry of the bingo game, and the reflex unit and all that kind of stuff was intriguing to me. But I never looked at like a Williams game. I didn't want to start thinking like them. You know, I didn't want to even see what they did. Evans Company made a game called Ten Strike.
I remember that game.
You remember that one?
Sure.
Very famous game.
Sure.
A lot of them were made.
With the American,
a lot of them.
Bowler, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a wonderful game. And so Harry Mabbs was designing at the time, and he made Ski Ballette. But it ended up a Ski Ballette, and it was the same thing as a mannequin would throw the ball, and would go up into a rubber cup, like ski balls used to be. You know, they used to make these big ski balls at carnivals and things. And that was fine. Oh, what a wonderful, beautiful game. And beautiful siding. We had, we went all out on this game. Well, Evans came over and saw that game, and he tried to buy it from Gottlieb. He'd have paid him anything to get that game because he was so successful with Ten Strike. He wanted this ski ball at. Dave wouldn't sell it to him because Dave had visions of dollars and dollars and dollars, you know, what a wonderful game. Well, he was so excited about this game, Dave was, that he ordered the lumber in, and the sides for the cabinet were 3/4-inch plywood sides with a laminate side to it, and it's a laminate. It's beautiful. You've seen pictures of it, and it's just fantastic. And he even opened up another factory. It's down on 22nd Street, on the third floor of this big factory complex. And I was one of the guys that went down there to help build this game. So I know that game by heart. Anyway, it was an absolute flop. Flop. And it had a flaw in it that none of us ever saw. And the fact was, you either got the center pocket every time, or you never got the center pocket. See? So we tried to make it a loose connection with to the handle, to the knob, so they couldn't get it in every time, and then nobody would play it. So it was such a flop. So here we were. We had to close up the factory, and of course, what are you going to do with all this lumber? You know, it just, yeah, all this beautiful lumber, all these sides and all this. So what happened to it? Dave took all his lumber home to his house, and he built his basement. He paneled the basement with his thing all around, solid. And, you know, I could picture him sitting there at night looking at that wall and remembering don't make this mistake again, you know. Don't make this mistake again. Because he could sit and look at that every night, that mistake that he made, because he lost a bundle in that expo. Well, when I was in the pinball indoors, I didn't have much of a hobby on anything, I don't think. I didn't play golf or... I was family oriented, I think, and we did things as a family on the weekends, and we'd go places. And you know, I'd go when I was designing. I'd take the kids, and we'd go down to Museum of Science and Industry, as an example. And all the time I'm showing them around and doing this, I always had an eye out for something to pick up for another game someplace. You know, it depends on the game. And, you know, sometimes I would build them from scratch, and sometimes I would not. I'd take and cobble up something from a previous game, take a bottom panel and a light box, and I'd bring it in my room, set it up, and I'd take a playboard and I'd cobble into it so that I'd make a new game out of it, and which is to speed things up a little bit. But I always had five, six, seven games ahead of the production line when I was designing. And they come in and we'd fight, you know, about which game they're going to take next. And they always wanted to take the newest game that I made instead of the oldest one, see. But there was a certain progression between these games, and I wouldn't let them take the newest game because it would kind of outmode all the others.
Of course.
And so that sometimes got pretty heated. And I'll tell you a little something went on. One time we were trying to decide which game to take and whatever, and it got kind of heated. They were trying to tell me how to do something on a game. I don't know what it was. And Dave was sitting up on the stool. He always came in and sat on my stool I used on my drawing table. And he'd sit up there and he very seldom said much. He was pretty quiet. All the rest of his guys would argue, you know. And sometimes get a little heated and they want to change this, change that, change this. And one day he said, "All right, everybody out." He was fed up, see. "Everybody get out of here." And he chased them all out, and then he says to me, "Wayne, you do anything you want, and that's the way it's going to be built."
Oh.
I had the supreme power, and I had it, and I used it too, you know. Tony Gerard, our superintendent, he was in charge of the company, and he was in charge of the company making money. Mm-hmm. In other words, he had to show a profit at the end of the year. So he was always interested in what I put into the game. Mm-hmm. Now, on any given game, there's so much fixed cost. You see, you have your cabinet, you have glass, you have screening, you have transformer, motor, score units, legs, cash box, coin chute. These are all fixed costs. What have you got left? Nothing. You got nothing left. You know. So what do you got? A dozen relays. That's all he got left to work with as a designer. Again, and he would come in, and he was a sharp guy. He had a mind, and he counted the relays, you know. He'd go down the line, count them. And, you know, you could see the dollar bills running up in his mind.
For sure.
And he knew probably to the penny what that game was going to cost to produce. And if I had one too many relays in there, he'd tell me, "Take that out. You got to get a relay out of there. You got to get one out." And I said, "Tony, I already took one out of there." If you already took one out, okay. But I used to tease him a little bit, you know. But he knew I was teasing him. There's so much more in designing than designing. You had to build a game. It had to be an interesting game, first of all. It had to be fun to play. It had to be fun. But it couldn't play too long.
Right.
If it played too long, that was no good. The operator couldn't make any money.
Exactly.
You know, that would be no, you know. And then if it cost too much, if we had too much in it, they couldn't build it because they would lose money, right. You know. And then it had to have winning free plays. You had to win the right amount of free plays, or if they won too many, the machine would make no money.
Sure.
I mean, all these factors came into the design. It wasn't just building the game, but you had to play the game, make sure that the time was right, the amount of free plays won was right, and the amount of material was right. Then the game is acceptable.
What do you think the average free play percentage was on games, say, from 40s, 50s, and 60s?
In the area of 40%.
40%?
We'd figure 40% when we played it. When I played, I played for 40%.
Okay. And what do you think?
If I was winning 60, 70, 80% on the few games I played, I would have to do something. I'd modify it. And I always hated to open up the bottom. So that's what led to the holes up the board. You know, when I put in, like in Niagara, you know.
Boy,
when I built Niagara, was there an argument, you know? Oh, God. No one will play a game where you lose a ball up in the middle of the table. It was always the argument, you know. I said, if you give them something when they lose a ball in the outhole up on the top, they'll play the game. So they couldn't lose a ball at the bottom very easily, and so that was great. I got away with it, you know. We made the first game, and it was successful. And then, of course, I come along and made Queen of Hearts, where the ball fell through the hole. Holy mackerel! You would think the world had come to an end. All the guys, Tony and Bob Smith and all, and Alvin. Oh, they'll never play a game like that. Never play that. Like, who's going to shoot in the outhole? And, you know, I've played the game many times and since then. And whenever I see a Queen of Hearts, I love to play it. Because I shoot for the holes, you know. I want to put one in each hole, you know. Of course, what you do, you get one or four across and you blow it. You put it in the wrong hole, of course.
Right.
Fantastic game.
You get five balls in the same hole.
Five in the same hole.
Oh,
you know, that was a fantastic game, and that's why it was my favorite game. And
that was your favorite
favorite game of all time.
Of all time.
Of all time, yeah. Yeah. I like a lot of games. I like this the Spirit of 76, a fine game. But I like a lot of games, but that one, Slick Chick, of course, everybody likes that game. But that Queen of Hearts has got something that no other game I've ever played has. I don't know, maybe everybody don't agree with me, but I think it's the best game ever built. Another crazy thing I did was double award.
Oh yeah, tell us about that.
Well, you know, I was playing along in a game one day, and I came so close to winning, and I said, wow, next game, I'm going to kill this game. I can kill it, you know. And I said, if I had a chance, I'd put another nickel in here. I wouldn't double. I'd double it. And I said, hey, that's like not a bad idea.
Okay.
People are going to get the idea that I'm going to kill it on the next ball. Uh-huh. And so I put it in the game. Nobody knew what was going in there, you know. And when they came in and played it, and they saw that double award on there. What is this? What is going on there? And I explained it. And they said, oh, no one's ever going to put another coin in. No one will ever do that.
So the concept was, instead of putting in one coin, you put in a second coin at the beginning of the game.
Before you shot a ball.
And if you win a replay, you win two replays?
You win two replays, yeah. Yeah, we had added an extra coil in the free play unit that would cause it to step two teeth.
Twice, right.
Instead of one tooth, you step twice.
And how popular were the double award games?
Wasn't very popular. No, but it was a gimmick. Yeah. It's a gimmick, you know. It sold a few games, and that's all you could say for it. It was just a gimmick.
Yeah, if you could tell us, please, the story of how Slick Chick 1962 came to be named.
Yeah, Slick Chick was actually became a very popular game. It was one of the best games built, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it originally was called Party Girls.
Party Girls.
P-A-R-T-Y and G-I-R-L-S.
Okay.
But Party Girls is kind of risque. In those days, today, you know, But back in that day, it was, to me, it was a risque, you know.
Sure.
And I was looking for a name that was better than that, you know, but I couldn't come up with one. So this one Sunday night, we were going over to a friend's house for dinner, and I hadn't been over there in quite a while, and so we drove over, and then we came around the corner by his house. Here was this big restaurant that just opened up, and called Slick Chick, and that sign was must have been 10 foot high. You know, Slick Chick. Wow, what was I looking for? But that name, and so I went down to Gottlieb the next day and put it on the game, Slick Chick, and that's how the name came on, Slick Chick.
Okay, because on the back glass it looks like there are girls dressed in bunny suits sitting on chairs. Were there any fears that maybe the Playboy company was going to be objective?
Well, we did a lot of things in those days that today we would have been sued.
I would imagine.
Oh, you know, there's so many names, you know, that we didn't even give it a thought. Never thought of it, of being sued. People weren't in the business of suing people at that time. And I think they thought, well, that's good publicity, you know. And that was a great game.
On the playfield artwork, there's what appears to be a barbershop quartet, or maybe that's on the back box. Yeah. So it looks like Gottlieb went out of their way to try to make the game look wholesome and not anything but risque.
Yeah, well, Dave was very conservative. And Parker would come in with artwork where the girls were too revealing. He'd have Parker tone it down a little bit. Tone it down, Parker, you know. And Parker just take out his pen or pencil and done, you know. Parker was a wonderful artist and so cooperative. He worked with us and never complained. And we could criticize him and it just rolled right off his back. Not many artists you can do that with. You got to be careful how you criticize an artist, you know. You can't tell them that that's too much of this, or the legs are too long, or the or whatever, you know. You got to be very careful. Not with Parker. He was...
Was he kind of subdued in real life and more, I guess...
Very subdued.
Of an introvert, I guess.
Yeah.
You'd never know it by looking at his artwork.
He never played a game.
Never. Really?
And not in our office did he ever play a game. And we were always in the showroom when he would come in to pick up a new game, pick up our drawings and discuss the game. We'd all be in the showroom with all these games around us. And other guys would be playing, but he would never play. So, he'd come in, generally he'd come to our office late afternoon, 4 o'clock, 4:30 in that area. And then he would go home from there. He lived north in Skokie, I think it was, or up in that area someplace. And so he would come from reproduction or ad posters, stop off our place, and then go on home. And he had a studio at home that he worked out of, too. And sometimes he would work at home. But this one time he invited four of us. I think it was Tony Gerard, myself, and Smith, maybe only three of us, to his house. And we went up there and had supper. His wife cooked dinner for us. And he showed us, went into his studio, and we saw his studio and how he worked and so on. And he was very congenial and great man, good friend and a good man. And you know, he could come in at 5 o'clock at night, 4 o'clock, and we'd give him a change to make, maybe a big change. And he would go home and work on it and come back in the morning. He'd be standing outside the door in the morning when we came to work. Yeah, he was conscientious and didn't mind working late at night.
Were there times when the two of you would collaborate? In other words, you would say make him a suggestion artistically, and he would make you a suggestion in terms of design.
Sure. Oh yeah.
Would that happen
often? Quite often. You know, we talk about it. You know, and sometimes we didn't know what we wanted. You know, Parker, whatever you think, you do it. You know, and here's a drawing. Here's where the units go. Here's where the score units are. Here's this and that. Sure. Let's see what you come up with. And he'd come up with some of the craziest things you've ever seen. You know, he was a great artist and a good man. A good man.
Typically, how would the process work when you were designing a new game? Would David Gottlieb say, okay, this month we're going to make a bowling-themed game. This is the theme.
No.
And then he would come to you and say, okay, you lay it out, and then Parker would do the drawing later? Or what?
No.
What would the typical sequence be?
The typical sequence would be start with me, and I would make a game.
So design game.
And I would draw a back glass for it. Sometimes I'm not a very good artist. In fact, I'm probably one of the worst artists that ever lived. But I would draw, you know, and I would draw. And you saw the one with the palm tree and the monkeys climbing a palm tree.
Sure, yeah. So
that type of thing. And it was just a suggestion to Parker what we wanted. And you saw then how he came out, you know, because he did it in a professional manner.
Okay.
But I would draw what I thought, you know, and sometimes he wouldn't even pay any attention to it. He'd do his own thing, you know. But I never cared. I didn't do it because I wanted it that way. I did it just to have something to put on the glass.
Okay.
I put it up there. And so when we played it, and well, you've seen all the games lined up there in front of me. I had a piece of paper over them with something on them. So
the theme itself would sometimes be the last thing that...
Well, sometimes, but sometimes it would start with me. I'd set the theme, you know, like when I made basketball, as an example. You know, that was, the theme was set, mm-hmm. you know. Casey Jones, almost set, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just you... It comes to you, you know, and you just put it down, and what you think, and it's subject to change at any moment, you know. So, yeah.
It seemed like Gottlieb would focus on either things that would appeal to the common man, so to speak, the bowling or sports or cards or maybe current events.
Yeah.
Is that basically the way it worked?
Usually. We were common people, you know. We were common people. Yeah.
And the what would you say the target audience was in those days?
I always aimed at the 16 to 24-year-old men. Men. But we made a lot of games of dancing dolls or some other silly thing, you know.
Sure.
And I fight that every time, and I couldn't win. I said, how can you build a feminine game when we're targeting men? You can't build a feminine. But we did build several feminine games. But they all argued, well, men like to see the women too. You know, they don't mind that girl dancing around there. Come on. Quit kidding us here. You know, that twirling girl, you know, that's ridiculous. But, you know, you get outvoted all the time. And you know, you got to go along to get along. And that's what you do. When you design, you have to sometimes give more than... And I made a lot of games that were thrown out before. In fact, I made one game. It was a six-player called High Boy. And one of them was made. Just one. Yeah, and screen and cabinet and everything, playboard screen, made one game and shipped it out and never heard from it again.
The whole idea behind multiplayer games, in your opinion, do you think they were more popular, less popular than the single players? And if so, why?
Well, I'll tell you about that. You know, I often wondered, on a four-player game, how many players played on a four-player game at one time, you know? So I metered a game one time, a four-player game. I metered it, checked a number of times each player was played, mm-hmm. and we shipped it out. And it was out on location for several months. We got it back. You wouldn't believe the lack of players on the fourth player. I don't think it was 1% of the players ever played the fourth player.
That few.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was. I don't have the figures in my head because I've forgotten them. But if I was to take a guess, it would be 60-70% of the times one player was played. Mm-hmm. And 30-40% two players. And three and four, practically never. Mm-hmm. But you know, the very fact that you had four players possible to play was an incentive for people to buy this, for operators to buy it and put it on location, not knowing that the fourth player never got played. Nobody ever played the fourth player, but that didn't matter to us. We were selling the game. Our games worked. Our games really worked. And, you know, we had a system of trying everything out. We had in our boiler room, we had a steel vault in which we put everything, ran everything on test. And relays we'd run endlessly. They'd run for months on end with the relays operating. This one operated, this one which operated, this one. And that one would drop it off, and then they all start over and run again. Just brr, brr, brr. And it'd run like that for weeks, months on end. And so our relays worked. They never... And our step switches, we ran the same way. So our parts stood up over the years. And as you... As a collector, our parts are superior to Jenko or anybody.
Do you have any idea, in other words, that they were going to last
no.
this long, and that there
no.
would be collectors
no,
and
none.
Museums?
We had Boy, if we had known, we would have saved a lot of...
I would imagine.
Yeah. But I tell you, on Polina Street, we had a loft that was up above what we call the bullring, where our final assembly was. And up in this loft, it was a big loft. It was, say, 50, 60 feet long and 10 feet deep. And everything landed on that loft that after a run. The glass, playboards, plastics, our brochures, everything, throw up on the loft. And when the loft got full, we'd hire a truck to come in, and they'd push everything out the loft, everything out that window.
Oh, no.
Everything. And you collectors, you know, you'd die if you saw everything going out that window. Yeah. And, of course, at that time, all you wanted to do was clear the space, get the stuff out of here. You know, they used to have knockoff buttons on machines. You know what a knockoff button is?
Yeah, take the replay unit down to zero. Right?
Yeah.
In a hurry.
Yeah.
So when the cops walked in.
And there was a meter that would register how many, you know, and the operator, when he come to collect, he would take and do this and that. So there was a time when you had to take and work it with your hand, with your finger. You would, each time you push it, would knock one off, you know. Then they got more sophisticated, and
it
just hit one switch, and it would run back by itself, you know, which is very good. So that they were building them like at that time, like that, where the one switch would send them off. You had to just tap the bottom of the cabinet to do this. So, one day I was designing my games, and the telephone rang, and I picked up the phone, and as the girl at the switchboard, she says, "There's a man out here wants to see you." And I thought, oh, you know, nobody comes to see me. No, nobody. I never had anybody come to see me. Went to the door, and here was a government agent.
Uh-oh.
He had a subpoena, and had to appear in court, and I think it was in Albany, New York. And the government had a case going there. They picked up a game of gambling, you know, and I had to testify on this case. Well, that was only the first case. I testified on several cases, but that was the first one, was my crowning one. And so I went there. I told Dave, how did they get my name? But I know how they got it. Dave did it, you know. Of course, he didn't know nothing about it. But anyway, I got stuck with this job of going to New York. And I said, well, I'm not going there without a lawyer. I don't want to get caught on something, you know. So he said, well, we'll send our lawyer with you, you know. And so so he did. And so I went, and I got off the plane. It was on a Sunday night. And here was two men from the Justice Department meeting the plane. And he said, boy, are we glad to see you. He said, we got this game up in our office. We got to take it to the courthouse tomorrow, and it won't knock off. He said, it won't knock off. I have no case, you know. So, oh, boy. And I said, well, it can't be so difficult to figure out, you know. So, anyway, I go up to the office on a Sunday night. It was late at night, 9, 10 o'clock at night. Go up and open up the game and look. And here what happened was the operator had taken the switch, and he soldered wires onto it and let it out the back through a little hole he'd put in the cabinet and went through the floor, obviously, and under the floor up to the bar over on the other side of the room. And the bartender, the guy would say, I want to quit, so he just pushed the switch and knocked him off, you know, which was... Anyway, the government agents went in to confiscate this game. They don't know about the wire hanging out the back. They pick up this game and haul it out the front, ripping the wires off. So I come there and I see, I open a cabinet up and I look inside, and here was one wire that stuck out of the cabinet about so long, and the other one was broken off inside the cabinet. Well, you could see immediately what happened, what went on. So I immediately put the two wires together and they were so relieved. Oh, how did you do that? How did I do that? And so then I explained to them how it worked. See? So that was fine. So they were so happy, and we all went home, went to bed. And the next morning, they had the game at the courthouse, and my lawyer, in the meantime, had showed up, and he brought his wife with him, and so we all three went in, and we sat in the courtroom, and the case started. And this old guy, the old judge, he was an old, crabby, miserable You know, he's just a miserable judge. You couldn't describe it. You know how judges all have that straight face and the mean looking.
Sure.
Well, he looked mean, see. And so Rufus, our lawyer, he said to me, Wayne, if you get that old judge to come down and stick his head inside of that cabinet, I'll buy you a bottle of liquor. And I said, oh, you got a deal. I'll get this old boy to come down there. So an hour or two goes by, and I get on the stand, see. And this old lawyer from the other side was giving me a hard time. You know, we're going and going at it. Of course, he didn't know what he was talking about. He had no idea what the game did or anything about it. And the judge was more confused than anybody. And so he stopped for just a moment to take a breath. And I turned around. I looked up at that old judge who's sitting up here. I said, Judge, if you wanted to step down here, I think I could explain this to you real quick.
Take a look inside the cabinet.
Yeah. He gets up off his chair, and he comes down, and I get off the chair, and I come down. I put my head in one side, he puts his head in the other side, and he says to me, what the hell is going on? He says, I don't understand anything. I said, look, Judge, this is the way this thing works. You know, all you have to do is make one contact, and the relay takes over and does the resetting and sets the unit back to zero, and that's the way it works. And I showed him the two wires hanging there. He says, oh, okay, now I know what's going on. Go back, I understand. So the case is over. And so it went on for another three. Oh, I get back on the stand, see. And of course, his other lawyers give me a hard time. And I look and I hear the door opens up and this woman comes in and she's holding a bottle of liquor in a paper bag, you know. As his wife would, he sent his wife out to buy this bottle of booze. And she comes and sits down and he holds it up like this. Oh, laugh, I tell you. And we laughed all the way back to Chicago that night. Yeah. It was a funny day. I was on several cases. I went on a very serious case to New Orleans when Ballet had a test case with the government, and I testified for the government. And I told them after that, I said, "Don't ever call me for another case. I'll never testify again, because it was too scary. I mean, the hoodlums were involved now, you know." And I said, "I'm not going to be in any more cases. I'm through." And they never called me again. So, but to tell you, you talk about Sweet Adeline, that was a takeoff of a bingo card. Now nobody knew that. Mm-hmm. Dave didn't know it. Nobody at Gottlieb knew it. You know, in fact, I didn't tell anybody until many years later. But those numbers, they're listed
on the school,
and those numbers are, you could just take and place them on a bingo card. You know?
Right, yeah, it was 1 through 33 or something.
Yeah, they were. I was taking them off a bingo card, but nobody ever knew that. You know, they said, oh, gee, what a great idea, you know, what a great idea. You know, you get a line. Actually, the line went across or down.
Yes.
You know, well, this was just, straight each down. One went vertical. Yeah. No one ever knew it was taken from a bingo card.
If Dave Gottlieb had known that, he probably would have been.
He wouldn't have built it. Yeah. He wouldn't have built it, no. He would have thrown it out before it got very far. Because he didn't want a bingo game. Williams was a good competitor. Genko was a good competitor. And Williams, you know, we almost bought Williams one time. They were for sale, Williams was. And we were the powerhouse at the time. And we went over there and analyzed the place. Bob Smith and I and Elvin and somebody else went with us. Four of us went, and we spent several hours over in their factory looking, and we came back and said, all they got is junk over there. It's all junk. What would we be buying all that junk for, you know? Well, it ended up that they ended up on top, you know?
Right.
They were the only company left.
Right.
And we went down, and they went up, but there's probably a good reason why we went downhill. And I was part of that problem. Of going downhill. I always blame myself as part of it, you know.
Do you think Gottlieb was slow to embrace the transition from electromechanical to solid state?
Exactly.
Was that the crux of it?
Yeah.
Why do you think that was? Why do you think there was such hesitation?
Well, I tell you, we were going, this is my thought. Now, of course, who knows, you know. But we were going gangbusters with Spirit of 76 and games in that era. We had three factories going, and we had hundreds of people. I'll come back to this in a minute, but we had maybe 400 games a day, or 450 a day. Now, that's one every 15, 20 seconds. We had to make a decagon unit every 15, 20 seconds just to fit into this production. It was fantastic. It was just a madhouse. And as a chief engineer, my time was taken up almost 100% with what was going on in the factory. Because we had the Fargo, North Dakota was our cable factory. We had a ship wire up there every week. A truckload of wire went up every week, and a truckload of cables came back at the end of the week. And they had better be right. If there was a wire wrong, we were in serious trouble. And so my time was taken up, and so I didn't see the electronics coming. And there was nobody else to see it. And of course, they were, Williams and the other guys, Valley, were all making these electronic, fooling around with electronics and getting their systems ready, and we didn't, you know. And I blame myself for not seeing it soon enough and hiring enough people so I wouldn't have to do it. But of course, I didn't understand electronics. I finally ended up hiring a couple electronic people, and we got started, but bought it from Rockwell. They made it for us, and it wasn't the best system in the world, and so we were kind of behind the eight ball, and we never did catch up. Never caught up after that. I think Gottlieb was down from then on, and they sold out the Gottlieb, but right at the height of when we were building the Spirit of 76 in that era, and of course we were just killing them at that time, and they paid a high price for it. And I always give Judd credit for knowing when to sell, you know. Yeah. Always selling the high dollar. Yeah.
There's an interesting story behind the Spirit of 76. Can you tell us how that came about, and in terms of
how I got this game?
Yes.
Yeah. From 76 was our bicentennial, and in about 72 or 73, I got thinking about this thing. It's bicentennial. Boy, that's a big thing in this country. Everything is going to be red, white, and blue. There's going to be flags all over, and I could visualize this thing coming up, you know. Of course, it never quite turned out as big as I thought it was going to be, but it was a big thing to us. And so we got to make a special game, red, white, and blue, and make a real special game and call it something in that area, some fancy name. And so I got Krinsky to build a game, and I helped him with it in a lot of ways, and I did a lot of the work. I mean, he did a lot of it too. So it was kind of a two-way street, and we got done with the game, and it was a great game, and I loved that game. And so we were sitting around the lunchroom table one day, and we were discussing how many games we're going to build, how many we're going to build. And at the time, we were building 2,000, 3,000 games of a number.
That was considered a
normal run. And so there was probably five or six of us sitting around this table, and Judd was in charge of and he said, well, let's discuss the Spirit of 76, and how many are we going to build? We got to get the material ordered, we got to get going on this, and we got to this and that. And the other. So he starts out with one thing. 2,000, another guy, 2,500, 1,500, it goes around the table. I don't say nothing. He says, Wayne, what do you say? You're not saying nothing. What are you so quiet about? You're never quiet, you know. What are you doing? I say, you wouldn't believe it. If I told you how many games we're going to build, you wouldn't believe it anyway, and all you do is laugh. And why should I tell you what you're going to build? You all, come on now, you got. And I said, well, all right, I'll tell you, but don't laugh at now, you guys, you know. And I said, 10,000.
10,000?
Everybody laughed. I said, there you go, see, there you go. Just, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Wayne. If we build 10,000 game, that 10,000 game is yours, and I'm going to deliver it to your house.
Oh.
And that's exactly what happened, and that's the game that's sitting in my garage right now. That's the 10,000 game. And you'll see the serial number on there, 13,000.
13?
Because we started at 3,000.
Very nice.
Yeah. That's, sorry, 1301. Actually, that was the first one. And this is a 10,000 game. Yeah. And that is a treasure. That game is a treasure. And it, I never collected games. I brought a lot of games home for the kids to play. In fact, I brought a Niagara home one time, and the kids loved that game, you know. And so,
what happened to that one?
Guy down the street came over one night. I knew him pretty well. He came over to see what I had, you know. He said, "Boy, I like that Niagara. I like that game. Can I buy it from you?" And I said, "No, I wouldn't sell it. Kids would kill me if I sold that game." So he says, "I'll give you a set of encyclopedias for it." He was an encyclopedia. Yeah, he ran this. And I said, "You would?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay, you got a deal." So he took the game, and I got the set of encyclopedias. And the darn kids wouldn't even talk to me after that. They were mad. They got rid of their best game.
I don't blame them.
Of course, all the kids in the neighborhood were the same way. They all put out. I got that. But then I brought another game home, and that settled it. Okay. I'll tell you a little thing about the wood rails. You know, we went to the stainless steel rail, not because it was better or anything, but because it was cheaper. You know, the stainless steel is much cheaper than that. Those wood rails were awfully expensive.
Uh-huh. The same would hold true for the legs.
The same with the legs.
Yeah, they're probably half as much.
Right. They were so much cheaper, and yet they're so much better. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
But in terms of wood rail designs, games that you designed in that era, are there any that you wish you had done better?
Well, probably all of them. Probably all of them. I'll tell you, one of my favorite games, which nobody ever mentions, is Lightning Ball.
Oh, that's a great game. I love that game.
But, you know, I had that game in my room when I designed it. Do you remember the game?
Sure.
How the detail of it?
The triangle rubbers,
and you had to shoot A, B, and C, and back. All right, when you shoot from the right flipper to the left rubber, and to the center, to the back, and to the left flipper.
All the way around, like,
yeah. Well, I got it going around, I think 16, 18 times without missing it. You know, back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah.
But I had drawn on the playboard a solid red line that was about 3/8 of an inch wide, maybe a half inch wide. Mm-hmm. The path was very important. As soon as they went to that lightning thing on it, I couldn't hit the ball. I couldn't get it going anymore. But going back and playing my original board, I had no trouble shooting that circuit, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was the game. And I told him, "You're missing the game. You're putting in the artwork is spoiling the game."
So whose idea was it to put the lightning bolt?
Parker.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, like I said before, you give. You have to give. You know, you're a team player,
yeah.
And the time comes, you give. I had my say.
I see.
I told him what I thought, and okay, whatever, you know. But that game could have been a better game. If the artwork was designed so that it showed that path, because mm-hmm. a player didn't pick it up. All is Attaball game for good.
Yeah, tell us, just if you could, how did Attaballs come into being, and what was the idea behind them?
Well, you know, that's a good question. You know, Texas, Wisconsin, I think, there were several states that wouldn't allow any pinball machines, none. You couldn't get a pinball in the state of Texas. So Elvin was down in Dallas, our distributor down there, and the distributor's crying because he's dying. He got nothing to sell, and he said, "Can't you come up with something that the players will play that could beat the law, go around the law?" And so he came back. Elvin came back to me, and he came into my room, and he's talking to me. He says, "You know, they got to have something in Texas that have no free plays. Again, no free plays on the game, but they want to play something down there. So can you come up with something?" And I said, "Well, I'll give it a shot, you know." And I came up with the Attaball, and you know, I started playing that game, and I loved that game. I loved that flipper game, and I called it Flipper in honor of Harry Mabbs. Because Harry Mabbs named the first flipper game Flipper. That was the original name of the flipper. Was.
Oh, that later became Humpty Dumpty.
Became Humpty Dumpty. Yeah, became Humpty Dumpty. And so all our Attaball games were called Flipper, Flipper Clown, Flipper Cowboy, Flipper whatever, you know, whatever. And it's all because I insisted we call it Flipper in honor of Harry Mavs.
Nice. You know? Yeah. So there were five games that had Flipper in the title.
Yeah. Yeah.
How well were those received? Were they? Did you make a lot of those?
Oh, made a lot of them for a while, you know, in Texas and Wisconsin and, you know, there were certain areas. And, of course, it led to the Italian Attaball game.
Oh,
and that was a big market. That we sold more games in Italy, I think, than any place.
Okay.
For a long while, yeah. For a long while, yeah. In fact, we were making four players, two players, five ball games, and Attaball games, and Italian Attaball, all at the same time. And we go right down the line making them. And by the time we come back to the original one, the distributors were crying for games. You know, if you were in a five-ball territory, and we made five-ball game, and then we went into all these other games, this guy had nothing to sell.
Oh, I see.
You know,
yeah.
And he was crying. When are you going to get some five-ball games going? And so we were going pretty good there for a while. Yeah.
Was Gottlieb the first manufacturer of Attaballs?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I made the first Attaball game. And, you know, in our showroom, we had the games lined up with the, we always had games in our showroom. We had a multiple player and a single player and an Attaball game and four player, two players, so all lined up. And every night, about 4:30 or thereabouts, we'd go in the showroom and we'd play the games. And we'd talk. We'd say, you know, we'd pass, you know, talk about what we did in the daytime, what we had hopes for, what we were doing, and touch base with each other. And whoever got in the showroom first would always go to the Attaball game.
Really?
Yeah.
And
Dave usually figured out he was going to get out there ahead of everybody, and he'd go to the Attaball game, and we'd come in, we can't get to that Attaball, see? But he loved to play, and he always played that Attaball game.
Yeah. I think a lot of that had to do with the appeal of the back box animation.
No,
unit, or
we never even looked at the back
box. Is that right?
No.
That was more designed.
The artwork is for the...
people watching,
I guess. Yeah, people watching.
As a player, you can't really look up and
no, see you know, you look at it and you enjoy it, like Barnacle Bill, you know, and thing. You enjoy seeing it, you know, and you look at it and you laugh and so. Once you play the game, now you're concentrating and you
sure.
Play the game. You don't look at that
no.
Back glass. But a lot of people think the glasses, the artwork is a big thing.
In terms of just games that are being designed today, do you think they're too complex?
It's all action and no fun to play, as far as I'm concerned. I don't see. There's no. I say there's no game there. There's action there, but no game. I try to tell Gary Stern, I tried to tell Gary that one day. He says to me, what's wrong with the industry, Wayne? What do you think? And I said, games are too fast. The average player can't play them.
Mm-hmm.
I said, why don't you go back to the old days, the way they used to make games, and make a game like that, modernize it, but go along with the features, have people to be able to hold the ball in the flipper and pick out something to shoot for and
exactly.
Aim, you know. And he said, oh, yeah, maybe we'll try that, you know, but he wouldn't do that.
Gottlieb
no.
Just use these sort of generic geometric shapes most of the time.
Yeah, and you know why that is?
Why? Tell us.
The cabinet company actually designed the design for the cabinet, not the artist. The artist had nothing to do with it.
Parker
never did it, no. He never did a cabinet design.
Huh.
And our cabinet company did that.
Oh,
and they just... And Dave says, I don't care what it is as long as it's red, white, and blue. You know,
yeah, they were usually red.
Mostly red, white, and blue.
Orange.
Yeah, not always, but
that's true.
Most of the time, red, white, and blue. Different squares, different
circles,
triangles,
half-circles.
Different. Yeah, but always red, white, and blue.
Yeah. So Gottlieb never made their own cabinets either, is that right?
No, we never made cabinets. No.
Why is that?
Well, you didn't want to get all that dirt and dust in the factory. We, you know, tried to keep the factory clean.
Okay.
And I don't. Of course, you've never seen a Gottlieb factory or a Williams factory or a Ballet factory. Gottlieb factory was spotless. They spent a lot of money cleaning. We cleaned the floors. Everything was dusted. Everything was taken. It was spotless. Well, I'll tell you a little story. I came back on leave, and at the end of the war was over. And, of course, there was a lot of people in the service, and then they were letting them out slowly, you know, and you had to take your turn going out, I guess. I don't know how they had figured who was going out next, but anyway. I come back to Gottlieb, and I went in the office, and there was Homer Capehart sitting in the office with Dave. They sit together a lot. Both of them were cigar smokers, and they'd sit there and smoke their cigars and talk the world over. So Dave said, "When are you coming back to work? You know, when are you coming back?" And I said, "Well, as soon as they let me out." I said, "You know how the Army is. They don't move very fast now that the war is over. There's thousands, millions of men that have to be classified and sent out." So Dave looks at Homer, you know, and Homer looks at Dave, and a week later I was out of the Army. Now, I know who did what, but I don't know who heads what. Nice. But I was out of the Army in 1 week.
Wow. Would you like, can we play some pinball on your Spirit of 76?
You want to get beaten? No, you guys
it
play.
It would be an honor.
Huh? All right. Let's do that.
Oh, that's
as to the what goes in the inspiration and the actual manufacturing and the enjoyment of many pinball machines over the years. And when you go back out into the main exhibit hall, take a look at some of the games that you see, especially in the wood rail and wedge head areas, and you'll see a lot of the familiar names of some of the games that were talked about tonight. And I can try and take any questions if you have. Yes, Gordon.
Sorry, I just wondered, do you have the CD that...
We do have it. Do you have it here, Will, or is that available to us, the CD that you've made of all the back boxes and playfield?
And the raffle, there's three. I can burn three of them and somebody can win one each night.
Okay, so yes, if you'd like to buy some raffle tickets, we do have some of those available. It's got pictures of the back boxes and many of the playfields of a lot of the games that Wayne, in fact, all of the games that Wayne designed over a six-decade period.
I just thought it might be interesting for the audience to see one of the two ones. I've seen it, and it's staggering. Yeah.
When you think of the level of, I think, the level of creativity that went into building and designing these games, you realize these guys were building a different title every month and a half on average in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. I mean, today you have Gary Stern that's cranking out, what are we talking about, three, maybe four titles a year? And they've got a design team with 15 to 20 people on it. Here we're talking about a design team of Wayne Nyans, Roy Parker and David Gottlieb and maybe one or two other folks. I mean, it's, the level of creativity is just astounding.
Game of one for 20 years.
This game here, you can see why. Go out and play this if you've never played this era game. This thing is so well designed. It's just incredible. Larry, wouldn't you say this is like one of the cleverest games of all?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And Niagara, by the way, was the first game that had the traditional V-shaped flippers with their rebound kickers on each side of the flipper. Prior to that, the games were usually the dyslexic sort of design flippers, whether it was six with Humpty Dumpty or four or two. But this was the first traditional shaped, and it was the first game to have trap holes. And as Wayne was talking about, that at that time the concept was, you know, you want the player to, the ball to last as long as possible, and to trap the ball was to give it up and to try to convince the player to actually want to lose the ball was a radical notion at the time. But you're giving up something, obviously, for something else. When you get the ball in the different trap holes, it would like the one-point bumpers, and you can win a game that way. There were no fewer than four routes to special, and that's what's so fun about a lot of the old wood rails. They have four or five different ways to win replays as opposed to the solid-state modern games that have maybe one or two. So, but yeah, it's just beautiful, beautiful game. If you were skillful enough to light the one through six pop bumpers at the very top of the playfield in sequence, each time you hit a pop bumper, it would, the guy in the barrel on Niagara Falls would come down the falls in back box animation. So again, thank you very much for attending, and I hope this really provided you with some insights as to how these games get built and designed and produced. And as I said, we are going to be filming more and more industry designers and artists, and our Pioneers of Pinball series will continue. So thank you again. Really appreciate it.